It's philosophy talk.
In most countries in the world now, certainly in all major cultural zones in the world, people prefer to live in a democratic political system where they can choose their leaders, replace their leaders in regular, free, fair, and meaningful elections.
John Locke said that the right to govern ourselves is basic and self-evident.
But is democracy an inherently good thing?
Or is democracy, as Plato thought, one of the worst possible forms of government?
Not all power is in the hands of elected officials.
Our guest is Larry Diamond, author of The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World.
I think our democracy has been more responsive than we sometimes give it credit for.
Recorded live at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
Is democracy a universal value?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is democracy a universal value?
Democracy, that is, a system of government by the whole population of, or at least all the eligible members of, a state, typically through elected representatives.
Now, that dictionary definition leaves a lot of room for variation. In a direct democracy, for example, the people collectively directly decide political matters. In a representative democracy, the people elect representatives to make the political decisions.
And exactly who is an eligible member? Only those over 18? Over 21? Only men? Only property owners?
In Athens, the world's first so-called democracy, women and slaves, that is, most of the population, were actually completely excluded.
You could say the same thing about the United States at the beginning. It took the Civil War, the 19th Amendment, the civil rights legislation of the 60s, along with the 24th and 26th Amendments, to really give us something approximating universal adult suffrage.
So democracy can take many forms. But our question isn't about this or that form of democracy, but is democracy itself an inherently good thing?
Well, Ken, democracy may have its flaws. And there may be better and worse ways to organize a democracy. But don't we have to agree with that great philosopher and statesman Winston Churchill when he said, quote, democracy is the worst form of government except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time?
Well, John, Plato was a much better philosopher, and he actually disagrees. He thought democracy was actually the worst possible form of government.
Ken, Plato favored an aristocracy run by philosopher kings. Try to get that idea to fly in the modern world.
But Plato's not alone. There were many more critics, including another great philosopher, Thomas Hobbes. He had a very negative view of democracy.
Well, democracy has also had its sophisticated philosophical defenders. John Locke, for example, took the right of self-government to be basic and self-evident.
And Locke's philosophical ideas heavily influenced our founding fathers, no doubt about it, at least their rhetoric anyway.
And aside from the strictly philosophical reasons, there are kind of empirical and instrumental reasons for preferring democracy to other forms of government. Democracies are less likely to go to war, more likely to make decisions that their citizens accept as legitimate, and more likely to command uncoerced loyalty and respect from their citizens.
Yeah, but Plato and Hobbes and other anti-democrats actually doubt something you implied. They doubt that democracies actually make better political decisions. The problem is that democracy puts a premium on the wrong skills, the skills needed to win office rather than the skills needed to govern.
Well, you may have a point there. The skills needed to win office today include being able to raise vast amounts of money, design clever campaign commercials, and give empty speeches that stir much emotion and little thought.
So is there any reason, really, to think that these skills are correlated with the ability to govern wisely?
Probably not. Still, whatever case Plato and Hobbes and other anti-democratic philosophers might make, there is today a clear consensus in America and the West that democracy is a good thing.
But is democracy a universal value? Or does our love of democracy stem from our culture and ideals that other cultures may not share?
Well, there is a school of thought that says values inherent in certain Asian and Muslim cultures make them unsuited for democracy, or at least any kind of democracy that's familiar to the West.
And yet, when given the opportunity, people in those cultures push for democracy, from Tiananmen Square to the Arab Spring.
So do human beings, deep down, when given a real choice, actually always prefer democracy?
And are there sound philosophical reasons why they should prefer democracy?
We're going to put those questions and more to our guest, Larry Diamond. He's the author of The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World.
And we'll want our live audience here at the Morris to join in the conversation, too.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, talks to a Chinese journalist about the differences between the media in democratic and non-democratic societies. She files this report.
How does American democracy look to someone from a communist country? Major Tian is a Chinese journalist attending graduate school at UC Berkeley. He's reported in the United States as well as for foreign bureaus in China. Tian grew up on a steady diet of Chinese media. He says he was always critical of the information he was getting on TV.
They did a story on some pilot in the Air Force, and they showed their training with a video from the American movie, I think it's Top Gun.
That's right. China's state broadcaster, CCTV, tried to pass off a scene from the movie Top Gun as a real-life military drill. So when Tian came to California, he figured American media would be the exact opposite, and he thought he knew what to expect.
Before I came, I definitely heard that there are a lot of protests. In the Bay Area is one of the most liberal places in the United States, but I still was quite amazed by how many protests there are actually.
Oh yes, the Bay Area is known for its protests.
Foreclosures have got to go! Hey, hey.
Protests against foreclosures, budget cuts, wealth disparity, protests against affirmative action, even protests against dog parks.
Yes, we can.
If there's an issue, there's a protest.
I remember the first city meetings I went to is the planning commission meeting, and a resident was complaining about like an AT&T pole like in front of his house. So he said, I was like, that one is so ugly. It's just right out there in front of my window. When I was watching TV, I can see it right there that you had to do something.
Tian watched in surprise as the commission discussed the pole issue for more than 30 minutes, finally deciding that AT&T should plant a native tree near the pole to block the neighbor's view.
Well, that looks really democratic to me at that point, but I later found out there are actually much more important items on the agenda. Like they're about, you know, jobs, about buildings, about construction that can bring thousands of jobs and things.
Tian realized that while democracy seems pretty sexy, it can also be a drawn-out, inefficient process. Then there's the way we treat our elected officials. Tian was covering one Oakland City Council meeting where things got a little heated. Residents, upset about the massive budget deficit and possible cuts to programs, were screaming at the council president, Larry Reed.
We would like to call this meeting to order.
Reed he didn't yell, but he like fought back and said, I'm not ashamed of this council, please show respect, and we're doing our job, it's hard, blah, blah, blah. There's this back and forth.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Tian says in China, that would never happen. Another thing he's learned as a Chinese journalist in America, Western media can be biased too. He was particularly troubled by the differences in coverage when it came to the Beijing Olympics and the protests in Tibet.
I think people like me are lost in the middle, that we don't know actually what happened. They're basically like two extremes that we don't know who to trust, and we don't really want to trust either side of it.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
And we're joined now by Larry Diamond. He's the director of the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law, and he's author of The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World. Larry, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much, Ken.
So, Larry, anyone who reads your work knows that you're not just a scholar of democracy, but you're really an advocate. You're passionately in favor of democracy. How did that happen? How did you become so interested in and committed to the spread of democracy around the world?
Well, partly it was shaped by growing up in the 1960s. I started thinking about politics in America and the world around 1960 when John F. Kennedy was running for president, and then I was very affected by his inaugural address, which was a stirring affirmation of freedom and democracy, and also public service. I was heavily shaped by the struggle to reform and improve our own democracy with its very deep flaws during the 1960s in the struggle for civil rights and against the Vietnam War. And there I realized that public participation was necessary to defend and improve democracy. And this was also the time that many countries around the world were gaining their independence from colonial rule. And there was something uplifting about their struggles for freedom and popular sovereignty.
You were just swept up. And that became your lifelong passion.
Well, it wouldn't have been sustained if there hadn't been an empirical basis for it. But if you look at what has happened to different countries around the world living under different types of systems, I think you can make a very strong case that democracy is the way you get defense of human rights and human dignity and ultimately political stability and more sustainable human progress.
But democracy can be a rather vague concept. I suppose in theory you could have a state that elected a tyrant every 25 years and in between elections, the tyrant was just a tyrant. So it would be officially a democracy by the definition we gave, but not much of a democracy. Do you have a working definition of what counts as a democracy or some criteria that a state has to satisfy to be reasonably called democratic?
Yes, it's a political system in which people can choose and replace their leaders in regular, free, fair, and meaningful elections with, as you mentioned before, universal adult franchise. Regular means it's got to happen more than every 25 years, John. Really, you know, at least every few years by some minimal prescribed constitutional interval. And free and fair means there has to be some kind of level playing field and some degree of protection for rights of freedom, expression, organization.
That sounds like a pretty high bar. Regular free and fair elections, protection of human rights. I think, I'm not a scholar of the world like you are, but I think there are lots of places that have sort of the form of democracy. There are elections, but they're not regular and free and fair, and the states don't necessarily protect human. There's lots of corrupt. By your standard, which is a pretty high standard, what percentage of the world is democratized now?
So by a standard that I would say is a reasonable minimal standard that doesn't require perfection, but at least a meaningful ability of people to change and replace their leaders as I described, about 60% of all the independent states in the world, and that's actually a majority of the people living in democracies now, because though China is obviously not a democracy, India is an electoral democracy, Indonesia is an electoral democracy, the United States, Brazil, those are already several of the largest countries in the world.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco. We're asking, is democracy a universal value? With Larry Diamond from Stanford University.
In our next segment, we'll talk more about the problems inherent in a democracy and whether it's still the best form of government in spite of these problems.
Democracy, its principles, its problems, and its prospects, along with questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Candidate one wants to blow up the moon. We don't need it, he says, let's undoggle that boom. Candidate two says that science is bunk. Life is too short to read all of that junk. Candidate three doesn't think we've evolved. Listen to Jesus, your problems are solved. Candidate four wants to starve out the poor. No money, no food, says the father of four. Don't vote for me if your thinking's not right, if your heart's off your sleeve and your head's not on tight, if you think you're forgiven, if you think you are free. Stay at home in your hovel and don't vote for me.
Thanks to our musical guests, Merle Kessler and Joshua Raoul Brody. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're asking, is democracy a universal value? Our guest is Larry Diamond, author of The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World.
The members of our audience here at the Marsh Theater are part of a number of democracies, the United States, the state of California, the city of San Francisco, possibly your own families. From our participants' point of view, what makes for a true democracy? Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either side of the stage.
So, Larry, I think I agree. I've lived in a democracy all my life. I think I agree that democracy is the optimal form of government. But I want to get to this Hobbes-Plato thing for a second. I mean, just think of our electoral process. And what actually happens in our electoral process? A considered weighing of the options and people trying to persuade each other reasonably? No, it actually brings out the worst. It, pandering, deceit, character assassination, and all of the service of what? Raising lots and lots of money and sort of mobilizing people rather than informing people to get out the vote. Is this really a reasonable way to pick a leader?
Well, first of all, there are different types of democracies in the world. Some restrain the use of money in politics and level the playing field in elections much better than we do in the United States. When you have a First Amendment that is interpreted as overbroadly as the Supreme Court has done, to the perversity of saying that spending money in campaigns is protected as a form of free speech, you get an extreme and I think distorted version of what freedom to campaign should be. That's the first point. The second point I'd make is, you know, we have the ability to reform and improve our democracy in a lot of ways, not only by changing the rules to make campaign finance more fair and more transparent, even if money's going to flow into it at the levels that it does, but also by participating ourselves. If it hadn't been for the infusion of participation and the new technology of participation over the internet, both in advocacy and in financial contributions that happened in 2008, Barack Obama would not have been elected president.
But I want to back you up. Okay, participation is a good thing, let's suppose. Well, maybe not, because think Plato and that his critique. It's that the art of getting elected to office is the art of pandering, he claims, to those who know less, right, and who aren't aimed at the truth, they're guardians of their own interests, their own local parochial interests. It's the art of pandering and mobilizing. What does that art of pandering to local parochial interests and emotion, what does the art of pandering to that have to do with the art of governing? Those who govern should be focused on the true, the good, the right. Well, but those who get elected have to pander to the beast, as he put it.
First of all, one man's pandering is another man's responsiveness to the public will and and the diversity of interests we have in our society. And a lot of this philosophizing, going back to Plato, assumes that there is some objective public good out there,
right,
that can be understood by a philosopher king that is different than the aggregation of different interests in society. And I think that that's a questionable assumption.
I
won't necessarily say fatally wrong, but certainly questionable. And I think the big problem is not so much the pandering, it is that the power of corporations and the mobility of corporations has become so strong that we don't have an adequately level playing field in the advocacy for different policies and interests. And so some interests drown out others.
You're right about the Platonic critique. It assumes there's objective truth about this, and that the philosopher kings or the aristocrat, freed from having to pander to the public that doesn't seek truth but can just study the truth. I grant you that's a problematic assumption, but let's put it a different way. Suppose there's an ideal solution to this, to a problem in collective decision-making. There's an ideal solution.
Like, for example, raising taxes and cutting spending.
Right, something like, whatever. The question is, are we more likely to get to that ideal solution through democratic means or through non-democratic means? If I'm free from the constraint of having to please the people with their partial grasp of things, might I not be freer to get to the ideal solution?
Sure. That's the argument for China today, that not having the burden of having to aggregate a lot of different interests and pander, quote unquote, to different constituencies in regular elections, the Chinese national leadership can just decide we need a bullet train going from here to there, and it's not going to be mired in 20 years of right. regulatory red tape. The problem is that all sorts of human interests get crushed in the desire to quickly achieve what a narrow and unaccountable leadership has decided this is the national interest. Human rights are violated, environmental rights have been trampled, corruption runs rampant because there's no check on these people. So it's not just decisions at a moment in time, it's the sustainability of all this. That's why Tom Friedman jokes in his books and in his column, if only we could be China for a day.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, it's easy. Maybe it's not easy, but it's not all that hard to knock China. But doesn't the United States fall far short of being a democracy? I mean, we say we have three branches of government, but we really have four parts. And of those four parts, the House of Representatives and the President are the only ones that are democratically elected. The Senate is completely skewed in favor of non-urban, non-minority states. As a Californian, I have about 1/1000th of the voting privileges of somebody from Delaware or Wyoming. And the Senate is basically responsible for the Supreme Court. The president nominates, but he has to have his eye on the Senate. So aren't we far from being anything like the democracy we claim to be?
I think that we are not nearly as good a democracy as we could be. And if you look at the ratings of The Economist magazine, the Bertelsmann Foundation, and other organizations that rate the quality of democracy annually, indeed the United States is, you know, not even in the top 10. Most, you start with the Scandinavian countries and then go down. But the reason is not because we have a Senate whose electoral logic is different from the House of Representatives. That's actually a defensible proposition by democratic theory in terms of having a bicameral legislature. The problem in terms of what makes the United States a lower quality democracy is, first of all, the very low electoral turnout rate in the United States, the significant hidden barriers to electoral participation, and now you have some states, particularly in the South, that have figured out that high turnout elected Barack Obama in 2008, so how can we make turnout more difficult in 2012? The enormous influence of money in politics, and a lot of the perverse rules, which aren't even in the Constitution, that enable tiny minorities to hold things up, particularly in the United States Senate. The problem with the Senate, in terms of democratic theory, is not so much the structure of the way it's constituted and elected. It's that 41 members of the Senate can filibuster anything, anytime they want, and I think that's an excessive concession to the principle of minority rights. And even a single senator, one senator, can hold up a nomination to an ambassadorship or a cabinet post.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking, is democracy a universal value? With Larry Diamond, author of The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World. We're at the Mars Theater in front of a live audience. We've got questions from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
I wanted to go back to China. And as an exhibit, I would cite the tiger mother phenomenon that we, I think, are all aware of. And are there stages of governance which, for a given society, and you can bring Russia in this as well, less democratic structures are more suitable? So in China, you had the role of the emperor, and generation after generation created an ethos in that country that was more totalitarian, more top-down, and therefore the people may appreciate that more. And I bring up the tiger mother because here is a highly educated woman, a law professor, who in many ways reflected that Chinese behavior to insisting, imposing. And so I would ask you, don't you take into account stages of evolution when you discuss that topic?
Well, you've just cited the two big challenges to the argument that democracy is a universal value. One is that there are different cultural norms, traditions, and kind of priorities in different parts of the world, and the other is the notion that at lower levels of development, people value something other than democracy more. To the first, I would just cite the public opinion survey evidence, which is increasingly abundant in the world now, using standardized questions so that we can really meaningfully compare across countries, that show that in most countries in the world now, certainly in all major cultural zones in the world, people prefer to live in a democratic political system where they can choose their leaders, replace their leaders, have freedom of speech, not have to live in fear. And the argument, for example, you didn't make it, but some do, that this is not what Muslims want, it's not what they value, is just shattered by the emerging data from the World Values Survey or the Arab Barometer, which shows very high levels of support for democracy in the Arab world. On the development side, you could certainly say this about China, but India is a poorer country than China is, and it has very clearly embraced democracy, wants to sustain democracy, and that's true of Indonesia now. It's true of many low-income countries in Africa.
But let's China for a second. Okay, the 20th century was a great struggle between totalitarians and the Western democracies, and they lost. The totalitarians lost. And it seems to me they were a complicated thing. They had the Soviet Union. I don't know much about the economy of Nazi Germany, but the Soviet Union had this one-party state, and it had something else, a command economy. And that command economy produced a huge army, but a third-world economy that did not satisfy basic human needs, right? And moreover, that one-party state, partly because of the economic deprivation that went with it, nobody missed the Soviet Union when it went away. Nobody said, oh, let us back in the Soviet Union, although some of people seem to have missed Russia, you know, Putin and all that sort of stuff. But here's the thought. Okay, the totalitarians lost the first round in the 21st century, but democracy plus capitalism is really struggling, and some people say it's going to be the century of China. Maybe China's found the ideal combination, a one-party state, but not a command economy. If you married capitalist economy with this one-party top-down state that didn't have to deal with all this noise, right, maybe you could get the best of both worlds. But you'd still have markets operating and all this, but you wouldn't have political turmoil.
Well, if you take the best performing economies in the world in the last few years in terms of significantly sized countries and their economic growth rates, you certainly would have China as number one. But right up there in the top five are India, Brazil, and Turkey. And those three are electoral democracies, and they're booming economically. So I think it's hard to make the case that authoritarianism is necessary for some developmental purpose to sustain economic growth rates. It really depends on the strategic advantages that a country has and exploits and the policies it puts in place for economic competition more than the form of government. But the other thing is China is now beginning to slow in its economic growth rate. It's got some big structural problems that it's not dealing with. In terms of a real estate bubble in China, in terms of deep environmental problems, in terms of the perversity of the one-child policy generating...
Are those things going to push it toward a pluralistic democracy?
Yeah, I think they will, one way or another. China is going to become a democracy, I think, in the next generation, the next 25 or 30 years, one of two ways. Either it's going to keep growing, maybe not at 8 to 10% annual economic growth, but 6-7%, and it's going to become a middle-class society, and middle-class societies value freedom, openness, transparency, self-determination. They're not going to put up with this for another generation. Or the bubble's going to burst, and people are going to say, well, the only reason we went along with this is because you were making us rich. Now you've stopped making us rich, so give us the right to determine our own future.
Good time for a question before the break. We might answer it after the break.
Hi, my name is Howard Ramsour, and you've talked about the theoretical problems with democracy, but I wanted to talk about a practical example of a democracy that's struggling and maybe unworkable, and that is the state of California. California embodies many of the different aspects of democracy. It has direct democracy, of course, with the ballot initiatives. It also has representative democracies, which has led us to the state legislature, and incumbents that are there for life. And it also, unfortunately, seems unchangeable, the structure, that is, because it's embodying the Constitution and other sorts of things. And I guess also you can see the degradation of public life here. I'm new to California, but the public education system used to be seen as one of the best, and actually back east people still think it's one of the best in the nation. But it's deteriorated, as have the roads, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess my question is, I'd like you to comment on a struggling democracy like California, and actually, can it be changed by the people, given the Constitution and the almost the impossibility of change?
Yeah, the broken democracy we're living in here. Political reform, we had an era of it in the early 20th century in the United States that brought the referendum, the initiative, direct election of people to the Senate instead of the indirect election we had. So at least the Senate isn't as bad as it was. And now we need a new era of reform, and there are many Californians who know that. There's some very exciting efforts underway. One of them is a group called Think Long that's been supported by the philanthropist Nicholas Berggruen. And they've been thinking about what the issues are and where the real gaps are in terms of our capacity, our rules that are stymieing us. There was a deliberative poll that was done this summer that brought a random sample of Californians together to debate on this, and there's going to be some constitutional amendments coming out of this process that will be put before the voters that will, for example, I hope, lower the threshold to get a budget passed.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking, is democracy a universal value? With Larry Diamond, who's director of the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law.
Now we're in the 21st century. Does the present era offer new threats to democracy that were unthought of not only by Plato and Hobbes, but even a century ago? Does the power of corporations create problems that we couldn't conceive of before? Especially now that the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, has decided that as persons, they have unlimited right to buy speech?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. We'll hear more from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Do not disappoint us,
King Little King.
We aren't quick to forgive. We know what you look like,
King Little King.
And we know where you live. We got torches and pitchforks,
King Little King.
Torches and pitchforks,
King Little King.
King Little King, King Little King.
Thanks to our live musical guests, Merle and Amy Kessler and Joshua Raoul Broody. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're here with Larry Diamond, author of The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World, asking the question, is democracy a universal value? And Larry, before the break, a member of our audience asked, what's your prescription for the struggling democracy deeply in need of aid of California? And I lived lots of places before moving to California, and I still can't get used to this idea. We have this huge initiative process, direct democracy. That sounds like a good thing, but there's so little deliberation. Somebody puts up a proposition, they mobilize interest groups, and somebody wins and somebody loses.
But there's so little thought.
I mean, that's
and
Plato's
there's an enormous
complaint.
Amount of money that goes into it, and oh, by the way, you can get anything on the ballot in the state of California or the other states that have this process that you want if you have enough money, because you just use a professional signature gathering company to get it on the ballot. But now it's become a vital instrument for reforming our political process.
Let's take another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Beth.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Corolla. And picking up on what Ken just said, and I'm afraid this is a bit more of a theoretical question than what was just discussed, it seems that what makes the Philosopher King option so interesting is that you know at least that with the Philosopher King, you have someone in charge who's very knowledgeable and very informed. And I'm wondering if perhaps there could be some compromise between the philosopher king model and regular democratic model. And I want to emphasize that I'm asking a theoretical question and not a question about whether this is practicable. But what would speak against having some minimum level of informedness or knowledgeability, in addition to a certain age, like adult suffrage, on the voters? Asking, is there something fundamentally undemocratic about asking for voters to be at least to a certain level informed about the issues at hand?
Well, we used to have requirements for literacy in order to vote. And I think it was fundamentally undemocratic. You may think it's a better system. That's your prerogative as an individual. But I think that every human being is of equal worth. And to say that people with lower levels of education or who may lack formal literacy or whatever it is don't know what their interests are and can't make sense of the issues, I think is really fundamentally wrong and unfair. And again, I think the Indian experience as an emerging democracy in India, where actually people of lower incomes vote at higher percentages than the wealthy and haven't done that bad a job of instilling accountability and rotation of power among parties over time, affirms that general proposition. I will just say, however, that we do have in the United States some gesture toward this. Not all power is in the hands of elected officials. We have a Supreme Court that's actually, once it's appointed, not directly accountable, not ever anymore accountable to any elected official. You may decide that that's not a good thing. And we have a professional Federal Reserve Board of economists with very great training. They have to be appointed by the president, confirmed by the Congress, but then for the period of their substantial term, they have the ability to have a very important role in setting economic policy.
Let me ask a variation on the question that Carolla asked. In our Constitution, there's really two sets of requirements. There's the requirements on the voters, which is now being 18, used to be being 21, and then there's the requirement on the office holder, which is being 25 for some offices and 35 for president, if I remember correctly. Now, that idea that, well, everybody gets to vote, but they shouldn't be allowed to vote for just anybody, that could be strengthened. You could, mm-hmm. you could develop some of Plato's ideas and mm-hmm. Confucius's ideas and say, well, the people that actually serve, the people that the population chooses among, they should be a special kind of priestly caste. They they should be, well, not philosophers, you know, because frankly, they're mostly pretty flaky. But but maybe sociologists and political scientists to well, get you behind this. But they could, you could say also they shouldn't own property, mm-hmm. right? They shouldn't be allowed to eat with people that have large amounts of money. I mean, couldn't we have democracy at the level of the electorate? Everybody gets to vote if they're over 18, but have some reasonable restrictions on who they get to vote for. Would that still be a democracy by your criteria?
It could be. There are democracies in the world that require a college degree even to be elected into parliament. But and then what happens is, I think this may even prevail in Afghanistan, you know, you get these kind of artificial mills that grant people college degrees that aren't really, I mean, it just becomes a joke. So I think any requirement like that can be gotten around. The key thing you want, first of all, is transparency, that if people have hidden or financial ties to vested interests, you want to be able to know that and judge that. And secondly, we can strengthen the rules against conflict of interest and have an independent agency that judges them. Why should it be the case that when there are charges or allegations of conflict of interest or misconduct on the part of members of Congress, it's not some independent agency that adjudicates it and imposes penalties? It's their fellow members who are all scratching each other's backs.
So look, I want to take you on another topic. Here's one of the things I think is a big threat to democracy in America and actually around the world. There are lots of other threats, but here's, I think, is a big one, a new one for the 21st, mm-hmm. late 20th, 21st century, the global international corporation. Because you want to hold corporations democratically accountable, but you know what? They're global things. A democracy is a non-global thing. A particular nation is non-global. If I will say, look, we're going to have environmental regulation, labor standards, you know what they can say? Eh, I'll go somewhere else. I'll move my factory here. You don't want me polluting the air? Well, these guys don't mind so much, so I move over there. So we can't really hold the global corporation accountable. I don't think the 21st century is going to be the century of China. I think it's going to be the century of the international corporation.
Well, to some extent, it already is. And I think part of the answer is that we need shared standards and regulations around the world that limit or some minimum floor of shared regulations and standards that limit the power of these global corporations to trap countries into a logic of a race to the bottom. You have to keep lowering your environmental standards, your regulatory standards, your taxing standards in order to keep or attract capital. So there's got to be some degree of greater coordination, and I'll repeat, greater transparency and the ability to enforce the laws we already have on the books. One of the great, I think, tragedies of our democracy now is that there were obvious crimes committed by our financial corporations in the misbehavior that produced the financial crash, and no one's been prosecuted.
But look what you said. Okay, in order to achieve this goal of holding corporations answerable to the polities
and the
actually,
law.
And the law, we actually need global institutions. So democracy as a local form of government is not
but
on its own an optimal solution to this problem.
We're not going to get world government anytime soon, and I
definitely
don't think I'd like to see it. And one reason why is I don't think it'd be very democratic. But what I am saying is that we do have growing coordination. I'll give you an example of it. In the 1970s, in reaction to many scandals in the United States passed the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that made it illegal, a crime, for American companies to pay bribes abroad to get contracts. For a long time, our corporations had to compete with both hands held tied behind their back because other countries didn't have that law. Then the OECD, which is the Club of Advanced Industrial Democracies, adopted that as a shared standard, and you can see more of that happening over time.
Well, my understanding is that the amount spent on bribery as a percentage of the gross national product in Russia is higher than the federal budget as a percentage of the gross national product in America. So
Russia doesn't sign on to that prophecy.
So it sounds like there's...
And it's not a democracy.
Yeah, okay.
So we got more questions. This side of the auditorium.
Well, one of the things I've observed over the years is that the corporations in America become, I'd say, more successful in subverting democracy by becoming the owners of the people that we elect. So we get to vote for whoever we like, but the voters probably aren't as important to them as the people who paid for the media and the advertising that convinced us to vote for them in the first place. What I see now is a great interest in the United States government in encouraging democracy abroad. And what it leads me to wonder is if the corporations have become so confident in their ability to manipulate a democracy that encouraging other countries to adopt democracy might be primarily to enable our corporations to manipulate those governments rather than trying to manipulate dictators.
I guarantee you that a corporation would rather deal with an unelected government than an elected government. It's much easier to penetrate and buy off, much less expensive. also, democracy creates unpredictabilities. So they would, I think in most cases, if their goal is to influence public policy, they'd rather have a narrower, what's called selectorate, in order to influence. But a lot of countries, most countries in the world, don't have this extreme handicap of a First Amendment protecting freedom of speech that's been interpreted, as I repeat, as overbroadly as the Supreme Court has just done recently, and by a narrow 5-4
decision. There's a theory of democracy, I guess it goes back to Schumpeter, that I think has some validity. I don't want to pick on the corporations, just elites in general. Mm-hmm. Elites sort of manipulate the voters, and there's competing elites, but the voters aren't really informed, they're not wise, they don't really understand the means to, they might know their interests, but they don't understand, you know, why should we do this means rather than that means, and the elites just manipulate them, and democracy is just a way for elites to fight it out over the manipulation of the public.
I think that is a misleading characterization of, for example, our own democracy. Okay, people may not be very well informed, but a lot of recent psychological and political science, social science research shows that people do have a broad sense of where they want the country to go and take certain cues from candidates and parties that simplify a morass of information down to something that they can grasp with a limited investment of time. They knew that the country was on the wrong course in 2008, and they wanted to change course, and they elected Barack Obama. In the opposite direction, they knew that the country was on the wrong path from what they wanted to see in 1980, that government had gotten too big, that we were trapped in stagflation, and they elected Ronald Reagan. Go back to 1932 with Hoover versus Roosevelt, and the same thing. So I think our democracy has been more responsive to this broad general sense that people have than we sometimes give it credit for.
Well, on that inspiring note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Larry Diamond. He's director of the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law and author of The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World. So, John, what are you thinking now? Are you you were always a convinced advocate of democracy, I think. Are
well, yeah, convinced? I think it's something we ought to try someday. I wish we could get back to a reasonable government in California. But with regard to the United States as a whole, I don't know. I see if you combine the way the Senate is chosen with the filibuster rule, you really get the population of a couple of southern and midwestern states can hold the whole country hostage.
Well,
it's hopeless.
You're hung up on the Senate and the filibuster rules. There's also the influence of corporations and the vapid media. And I think our public discourse is debased in this country, and that's a danger to democracy, too.
But the influence of corporations and the First Amendment comes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's a creature of the undemocratically elected Senate.
Well, the Supreme Court is a creature of the Founding Fathers, who actually took some of Plato's critique of democracy to heart and wanted to put in things that said this government can't just be instantaneously responsible to the will of the people. But you know what? This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow us on Twitter, and you can find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page as well.
And you can also sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. For the final word, we turn to the voice of the people, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, faith in democracy, or at least representative government, seems to be on the wane these days. The right is trying to keep poor people from voting, says the left, because they want to shrink government, and the left is trying to get poor people to vote so the government will go bankrupt from the entitlements, says the right. Either way, pretty soon, no more government. And isn't that what we all want? In reality, of course, it doesn't matter who we vote for because they won't be representing us anyway. They'll be representing special interests, lobbyists, the Koch brothers, and George Soros. Voters aren't responsible, so we should all just cheer up. Our continuing national disillusion does not prevent citizens, however, from either bemoaning the loss of civil discourse or contributing to that loss, sometimes both at once. Just this October, Hank Williams Jr. was a guest on Fox and Friends, who remarked that last summer's golf game between President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner was one of the biggest political mistakes ever, and added, quote, "It would be like Hitler playing golf with Netanyahu." Unquote. I have no idea what that even means. And the host apparently didn't either, so Williams expanded, quote, "I'm glad you don't, brother, because a lot of people do. They're the enemy, Obama and Biden. Are you kidding? The Three Stooges," unquote. Now, who knows how much further the bizarre analogies might have been thrown. We might even have learned the name of the third stooge. But more than this is not known. Now, a song by Hank Jr., "Are You Ready?" had been used for the past 20 years or so to open Monday Night Football on ESPN. But shortly after Williams' statements, ESPN announced that it was extremely disappointed with his comments, and as a result, it decided to pull the Open from tonight's telecast. Whether this is a one-time shunning or a lifetime ban, I have no idea, but Free Republic, a conservative web forum, immediately blossomed with comments, many of which accused ESPN of being run by libtards. You see what they did there? They combined liberal and retard to make a brand new funny word. To be fair and balanced here, liberals often refer to conservatives as wingnuts, which is another funny word. Hank Jr. did apologize for his remarks, as well he should. It's ludicrous to compare Obama to Hitler. Obama listens to his generals, for one thing. Has never annexed the Sudetenland, and has gone on record that the Holocaust was a bad thing. But here's my question. If you're trying to disparage a politician you hate, why is Hitler always the go-to guy for comparison? If you're trying to point out that polar opposites shouldn't play golf together, surely there are personages less culturally and historically fraught. Why not say Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote? Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty, Grant and Lee, God and Satan, India and Pakistan, Batman and Joker, Nixon and somebody on his list, Darth Vader and Obi-Wan Kenobi, Tweety and Sylvester, Goldfinger and James Bond. Oh, wait, they did play golf together, didn't they? And we all know how that turned out. A billionaire tried to rob Fort Knox and got sucked out an airplane window, just so a British spy could end up having sex with Pussy Galore. And is Obama Goldfinger or James Bond? I knew you'd say that, you libtard wingnut, you. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Merle Kessler and Joshua Raul Brody.
Special thanks to Eric Blazeski, Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, Dave Millar, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.